Hey, I'm Tracy Burns. I'm a financial advisor with UBS. This podcast is called Five Things. You're going to learn five things, then you're going to move on with your life because we're busy and we all have things to do. Look, this podcast started out as a mission to help women, to empower them financially, especially through divorce and transition. I have a super soft spot for female entrepreneurs. We have one on with us today. Entrepreneurs, small businesses, and of course, closing that wage gap. I have three young adults, two are women, and this podcast is my small little piece of helping us get there and decrease that wage gap, which of course is fodder for a whole nother day. So please, before we jump to today's topic, listen to the previous podcast. I know it's been a minute, been on a little hiatus, but I feel like today's topic, one, is super important, and two, was enough to get me rallied and riled enough to talk about it and start this up again. So we've done things like five things every business should know, the five people you should surround yourself with if you're starting a business, how to find the perfect board, which by the way, businesses large and small should have board members. And my favorite is the Girlfriend's Guide to Money, five things you should know. Mind you, it's not where Microsoft is trading right now. All right, so today's topic, like I said, has been everywhere. I've always talked about how personal wellness and financial wellness are so intertwined. They are one and the same as far as I'm concerned. If you're not feeling good, you're going to spend money. And if your finances aren't good, you're not going to feel good and stress levels go through the roof, all the things. But lately, we're hearing so much stuff about people taking these fat loss drugs. And I'm just so beyond curious about them. And thankfully, our next guest is here to help us through. But Just sit with this for a minute. Ozempic, Wegovy, other prescription drugs hit 9 million. That's a 300% surge in under 3 years. Now, I don't even have to introduce Ozempic because I feel like everyone knows what it is. It's much like saying happy holidays these days. U.S. healthcare providers wrote more than 9 million prescriptions for Ozempic, Wegovy, and similar obesity drugs during the last 3 months of 2022. What the heck? Jackie London is a registered dietitian, New York State certified dietitian, nutritionist. She has like all the things. Author, more importantly, podcast host, consultant, my friend, media spokesperson, and the now you're our now go-to person on all things these drugs. So first of all, thank you for being with us because I think this space is so dang confusing.
Tracy, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. And also, it is confusing and it's only increasing in popularity. And I feel like there's just so much information out there. There's so much clickbait headlines that it's really hard to know what's what. So I'm glad to be here with you because however I can help, I'm here to do it.
For someone like you who knows especially how to lose weight smartly, my grammar is not great there, but to make smart decisions, we could do it. And yet we are seeing all these people dive into these drugs. And so it leads us to your five things, right? And the first one is, you know, have I created, practiced, am I doing health promoting things? And you're telling me all these people are not, and they have to go to shots?
No, in fact, all of these people, not all of these people, but let's say a large percentage of these people, and these numbers are still not well known to us. A large percentage of these people are people who have tried everything. They have been building sustainable habits. They have been trying every lifestyle-based approach. They are probably candidates because simply because they have tried so many different diets in their lifetime, restrictive diets that may have, as every diet tends to do, backfired. So there is a population for whom these medications are absolutely appropriate. We now really have an understanding, a much clearer understanding of the fact that obesity is a disease. It's a part of, it's essentially can be a cluster of cardiometabolic risk factors, right? Including high blood pressure, high blood sugar. Sometimes the body weight is only one component of these things, right? It can come with a number of additional biomarkers, but it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. A lot of the time, and so many cardiologists and primary care physicians will tell you that they see people who tend to have obesity along with these other biomarkers and these other alarming biomarkers that raise your risk of having heart disease, of developing type 2 diabetes, of increased risk of cancer, of increased risk of cognitive decline. So there are many reasons to start these these medications, if you are someone who has struggled in the past and you have tried everything in your power to do, and you are still not seeing results, and you're now getting concerned that actually you kind of need to bring your blood sugar down, or you kind of really need to get your blood pressure under control. And the one thing that would do both of these at the same time appears to be some safe and effective weight loss. So that's really who these medications are for. People who have already started to put these things into practice and are simply not seeing any results in their actual biomarkers.
And I am like, I'm on that team. Like, I'm all for that, because to give it a financial angle, it is an economic problem for us too, right? The amount of people that are obese that, you know, quote unquote, weigh on the healthcare system, I mean, it affects all of us. So I get that. I get that 100% that we should support and help these people who have all the things and check all the boxes. That said, I feel like Hollywood has taken over, as they typically do. And now it's become a thing like, I don't feel like putting down the potato chips. Give me the shot. Before we get there and I start to opine, one of the things that you said, which I think is so important, is all about knowing the side effects, right? I'm not sure. I think people just presume they're going to lose weight and all is going to be well, but that's not really true.
No, it's not. So this is my big number two is, am I aware of the side effects? It's sort of like a big question mark, a question to ask yourself and a question to speak with your healthcare provider about, which is, am I really aware of all of the side effects that can possibly happen as a result of taking a GLP-1? And what do I need to know to kind of prepare myself ahead of time to make sure that I've kind of put a good plan in place for myself to truly feel my best while on one of these medications? So, you know, the primary side effect that I have seen plenty of patients with who come to me speaking to me about these issues are complaints of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and early satiety. This is the number one thing I hear, is that even people who aren't totally experiencing that nausea or vomiting, they are feeling early satiety. That is the main way that this medication works, is that it helps you. It works on a gastrointestinal hormone, GLP-1 agonist, and it therefore creates this feeling that you're fuller for a longer period of time. It really decreases the ability to feel totally starving at all days, times, moments during your week, your life, right? So because of that, if you are someone who is susceptible to feeling nauseous from things, if you're someone who has taken antibiotics before and that always seems to ruin your GI tract, and by the way, I'm saying this just as more anecdotally and less as a scientist here, because there's no overlap between antibiotics and GLP-1 medications. But I say that just because you need to know your own personal history when you do anything, but particularly when you start a new medication. If you're someone who is just nauseous easily, then these medications may be difficult for you to take. And that's just something that you kind of need to know going in with your eyes wide open. The other thing that I will say that has come up both in research and anecdotally for me as a dietitian is that people who start implementing lifestyle changes before starting the medication, as in they start changing their eating habits, they are people who have already made some of those lifestyle changes. They already have a dietary pattern that looks like more veggies, more fruit, more often, one of the kind of cornerstones of something I talk about all the time. If they're already doing that, they're much more likely to succeed on the medication simply because I have seen they have fewer side effects. So that nausea, that vomiting, that often comes with a combination of trying to eat some of the higher fat, higher in saturated fat, higher refined carb foods that you might have previously enjoyed and been able to tolerate, and now you can no longer tolerate them. And that's really because high fat foods stay in your stomach for longer. They're very difficult to tolerate if you have early satiety or if you have gastroesophageal reflux at all, right? So even if you're not on a medication, but you have early satiety or GERD, they can be hard for you to tolerate. So they're that much more difficult to tolerate. You wind up having nausea and vomiting. You can't really stay on the medication because it can be really severe. So that's just something to keep in mind. You want to make those lifestyle changes first.
But that's so interesting, because then it leads, you know, then it begs the question, do I even need the meds? I mean, you know, if I'm capable of making the lifestyle changes, I mean, so we're saying then I'm making the lifestyle changes and I'm still not losing weight. That's who the ideal candidate is, right? And just because Jackie mentioned it, GLP-1 is like the scientific term, right? If people hear that.
Yes. Okay. GLP-1 agonist.
GLP-1. Yeah, okay. I got, this is why I'm in finance and not science. I don't say any of the things right. So this is why we have you. So everything you just said, we are all fingers crossed hoping that our physicians tell us, or the person that prescribes it is going to give you the lowdown on this, not, gee, honey, you're up 15 pounds. Here, take this. Like, we're really hoping. Is that, are those conversations being had out there?
That's my biggest concern. I think that this is probably the biggest issue. First of all, I can't even tell you, I'm saying this now, I'm giving this advice to your listeners now about making those lifestyle changes first. And by the way, I should also correct that it's not just the lifestyle changes and then not seeing weight loss. It's, have I made those lifestyle changes, but am I not seeing weight loss? And in addition to not seeing weight loss, I'm also not seeing my blood sugar come down. I'm not seeing my blood pressure come down, right? Because I think sometimes we get too focused on weight, and that's when these medications can be abused, because some people, perhaps their biochemistry is not meant to be any smaller, but they can live very healthfully without taking a medication or without losing weight. And therefore we have to like live and let live, right?
100%. So we don't want to enforce that. 100%.
But it's so true, especially with physicians. I fear that that's not happening. That kind of nuanced understanding is not happening. We're just looking at body size as making a one size fits all recommendation in the medical community. And the other thing that I have personal experience with as a practitioner is that doctors are simply not doing this to the extent that they should be. They're not getting a detailed enough patient history to really be able to identify and discuss what makes someone a great candidate for these medications. They're also, I don't blame them. I blame the system, really, which is that doctors don't have time to sit down with a patient and really walk them through all of the side effects, all of the lifestyle changes that need to be made. More importantly, why not refer to a dietitian? That's really my kind of third number three point is, like, if you are not already referring to a dietitian, then you really need to make sure that you're doing that, because that's something critical for a physician, is that you're not meant to have nutrition training and education background experience. You are meant to seek another practitioner who does have that. So making that referral and making sure that a patient has resources and options available to them really is a critical component. Most often what I see from physicians is them saying, you know what, go on the medication and then you'll go see a dietitian, or then you'll start, let's get your appetite under control, and then you'll start to make those lifestyle changes yourself. That's not really how it works. Unfortunately, we have such a nutrition knowledge gap in this country that's really impossible to do. And it's also just asking so much of people. But more than that, it's setting them up to fail, because if they wind up feeling nauseous and feeling like they just can't keep food down as a result of starting the medication because they did not start those lifestyle changes first, then they're also not that likely to be successful on the medication, and therefore medication adherence is going to be down.
Right. So they'll quit. I mean, look, we can do a whole nother podcast about why we should teach kids about nutrition and personal finance in school and not trigonometry, but that's just me. But okay. So all this stuff is so important, right? This whole knowledge thing, because it's, look, and you can't do a broad sweeping brush, but there's a fair amount of incentive out there for doctors to prescribe drugs too, right? There is a financial incentive for them too. So like, we're not going to get into that, but that is also there. The part that bothers me the most and worries me the most about this are our lower income families, where maybe the incident of obesity may be a little higher among our lower income families. They are probably the ones that could benefit from this, and yet they don't have access to all the things you just talked about, right? To good doctors, to nutritionists like yourself, like that's all ancillary expenses. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Does insurance cover you? Like, so what happens with them?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think this is probably the biggest criticism of these medications, right? And it's why you see headlines like Hollywood weight loss drugs, is because these are, first of all, Wegovy, for example, was originally created, it's FDA approved for weight loss. The same is now true of Mounjaro, which is another GLP and GIP, which is another hormone combination drug. So these two have been approved for weight loss. The reason why you see headlines that use Ozempic as a keyword almost is because Ozempic has not yet been approved for weight loss. It's been approved for the treatment and the management of diabetes, of type 2 diabetes. So sometimes, but the preference for someone who is looking to lose weight, if you can pay all the money in the world, is to get something off label and pay out of pocket for it because it's a lower dose. Ozempic is a slightly lower dose. So you're not necessarily that much at risk for being on something that is a much higher dose that you may not need. And you know that. Right? So you're absolutely right. These are medications that when they have FDA approval for weight loss, then you are more likely to be covered. But if you're already struggling and you already are, you know, limited in your access to even getting the tools that you need to develop health literacy, you don't know what to ask for, you know, and your doctor is that much more likely to have you come in and out. You're usually seen in a clinic. Your access to these medications is just not realistic right now. And this is why, you know, and we've talked about this before, that some of these projections that are out there about the use and the widespread, you know, desire for these medications may not quite be as accurate as they've been projected to be, because actually the people who need them the most may not have access to them. Not certainly in the same way as you or I might.
Right. And I worry, and this is like slightly off topic, I suppose, but we have talked about this, that it's going to become this, like, we're going to become this nation of micro-medicated people that have the bag of Doritos. We'll just like slip Ozempic into your vitamins in the morning and everything will be fine. Do you worry that we could get there?
I do and I don't. I do because I completely understand the concern, right? But I will tell you from experience that it is a self-limiting medication. So in other words, you can't necessarily do some of those things that you might have otherwise thought you could, like consume that bag of Doritos and not feel completely sick after eating them, or even maybe not even able to get through them in the same way. So there is a lot of biochemical changes that are happening in a very real sense that are creating that kind of self-limiting behavior. But that doesn't mean that just because you're creating a self-limiting behavior doesn't mean you're creating new habits and new routines that are actually beneficial for preventative health, right? So you may have learned to eat less, but you're not necessarily learning how to prioritize lean protein, which is really essential for people on these weight loss medications because they really need to build free fat mass. It's not necessarily a great thing to lose weight in totality. You want to lose fat mass, not lean body mass. That's especially true of older adults. And then on top of that,
but that's super interesting. Like how would anyone know that, quite frankly, if you didn't have a professional like yourself, quite frankly, sitting down talking to you about this?
Right. It's not completely intuitive. I think that's a part of the issue. And the assumption from physicians, and it kind of brings us back to our health literacy conversation, like the assumption from health practitioners or physicians really who are prescribing physician, that you're just going to automatically choose these things because it's going to change your taste perception, is just not quite accurate. It may change your taste perception for certain things. There may be some things that you can tolerate, some things you can't. But it's really, again, back to that early satiety feeling of what your taste, of how your perception of food and how your desires for food actually change. There's a few foods that have come up more significantly than others. I've heard many people say that they can no longer drink alcohol. I've heard lots of people say that they have to limit the amount of coffee that they have if they can have it at all. A lot of people will say that they can't have alcohol or coffee sort of at the beginning, but then over time they're able to tolerate a little bit, but much smaller amounts. And then I have heard people say that they have a greater interest in veggies and fruit, which I think is really interesting. And as a dietitian, I'm like all over that, right? Like, yes, amazing. But the thing is that without necessarily even having exposure to that, if you didn't know that that's something that you really should be doing as a part of your everyday eating pattern, your meal and snack pattern, if you don't know how to put those meals and snacks together because you've just simply never been exposed to it, then it's very hard to actually create those health promoting habits that truly stick. Especially because these are not magic pills.
Well, and that brings us to your last and final point. Like, is it, you know, the coming off part, like anything else in life, right? You stick to something, you do great. I mean, heck, you can go on Jenny Craig if you want, or whatever those they are these days, and have meals delivered to your home. But it's the second you come off it, that all hell could break loose, right? So your fifth and final point is that, has that been made clear to you? I mean, to be honest, what happens when people come off these things? Do they blow up again? I would be afraid.
In many cases, so if you have not, let's say, started to put into practice those lifestyle related behaviors that actually promote overall weight management and general health and well-being at large, right? If you have not started to do that before taking the medication and while you're on the medication, it is very likely that the weight will come back and then some. And that really leads me to something else that's really significant. And it's so important that I mentioned, because I just feel like no one is talking about this enough, which is that weight cycling, we used to call this yo-yo dieting, right? Yes. Like weight cycling, where you gain and lose a significant amount of weight in a lifetime. Yes. This begets more weight cycling, right? So let's say you were to go off of medication, a GLP-1, you gain all of the weight back and then some, and then now you start freaking out. You're like, what? Like, what's wrong with me? It's a complete psychological meltdown cycle, right? That you go into this spiral, right? The shame spiral. Mm-hmm. And you wind up making choices that then can either increase your weight gain. They can actually make weight gain go more rapidly. They can increase that. Or you start making choices that are really restrictive, which also lead to more weight gain over time. But really, your only option then is to either choose to go back on a medication or choose some other type of very extreme, right, you know, intervention that is actually not health promoting for you at all. And what really worries me about that is that without that proper education, without knowing your resources, without putting those practices into place, the risks of weight cycling, the health effects, the side effects of weight cycling are themselves a risk factor for chronic disease. So you're at greater risk. The more often you're weight cycling, you're at greater risk for type 2 diabetes, greater risk for cardiovascular disease, greater risk for cancer, greater risk for anxiety and depression. So there's a lot of reasons to then say, wow, I really better use this medication, not as the be-all end-all, but as part of an overhaul of my health promoting habits and behaviors. I have to make sure that I keep those in place while I'm on this medication. In addition to that, coming off may not be that extreme for you. So I don't want to generalize, right? It may be that you regain about 5 to 10 pounds, which is very much normal in across the kind of GLP-1 landscape. It's normal to gain 5 to 20 pounds back of the weight that you've lost. But the question is, what does that really mean for you? How does that impact you psychologically? How does that make you feel? You know, like, you really want to ask yourself some of those questions about how does that make you feel? And is your health still stable? Because then if not, then it may be something to consider. I just think it's important that people understand, eyes wide open, that these may be medications for life. And that there's a risk of that, right? Because it may mean that you want to be on and off these medications, or to some extent on them just period for a very prolonged period. And that is a place where we have some research on how that works, on the side effects of doing so for the treatment of diabetes, but we don't necessarily have that on the books, you know, in peer reviewed journals yet, for how that will, what are the side effects of being on these medications for life from a research standpoint for weight loss specifically, in the absence of type 2 diabetes. So that's an important factor to just keep in mind. And that's something that I would want people to know, eyes wide open. I do think they're blockbuster drugs. I do think they're amazing game changers, but they have to be prescribed to the right people, right, in the right setting, in the right context, and with all of the information being presented and on the table. I don't want to be negative at large about the medications, but I do see how we're already starting to say, look how amazing these drugs are, when we don't quite know everything about them. And we still need to exercise some real caution when prescribing them.
Or exercise in general. Look, I think this is why, to me, this brings us back to your overall wellness, your financial health, your personal health, your stress levels, because everything you just said affects your stress, affects the way you perceive yourself, affects the way, therefore, you spend. And it just all circles, it's all interrelated. It frightens me in a lot of ways, because I feel like many things in the beginning, the people that really should be using them are not, it's not getting to them, because we money talks sometimes, and money has been able to bypass the rules in many ways. And these drugs are in the hands of people that maybe they shouldn't be in the hands of. And that, to me, worries me, because then down the line, like you said, we don't know what the health side effects are. We don't know what the financial implications will be on our healthcare system down the road. We could say that about a lot of things. COVID drugs in particular, right? Things like that. Like, so, totally. So we, like, I think the best phrase you said is eyes wide open. And you said it multiple times, because if you dive in, do it eyes wide open.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
Jackie, this was amazing. And I know this is like part one of like multiple parts for us on this, because I know people are going to have questions. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about how this is going to affect industry. But I hope the takeaway here is that one, people can reach out to you before we leave. You're going to give us your email. And two, just do your research before you start. You know, it's a shot, right? Is it a shot?
Or yes. Yeah. It's an abdominal shot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So before you start shooting things into your body, ask some questions. That's just me. You are amazing. What is your email so people can reach out to you?
You can go to my website to contact me there very easily. It's Jacqueline London RD. It's JacqueLyndonRD.
You are amazing. Thank you so much for your time and insert.
Thank you, Tracy. This was awesome.
It was.
This presentation is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. Neither UBS Financial Services, Inc. nor any of its employees provide tax or legal advice. You should consult with your personal tax or legal advisor regarding your personal circumstances. In providing wealth management services to clients, we offer both investment advisory and brokerage services, which are separate and distinct and differ in material ways. For information, including the different laws and contracts that govern, visit ubs.com/working with us. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA, SIPC.